Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sunny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm fine.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Everyone seems very excited today.
Yes, all right. I am.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we're going to go back to the Draft House this week. You know, we talked last week about the Alamo Draft House. I was sad because the DFW location's closed, declared bankruptcy. But there's good news this week. News broke that Sony Pictures Entertainment has purchased the Draft House circuit of movie theaters. The move was not, strictly speaking, permitted by the repeal of the Paramount decrees, which were issued in 1948. It was an antitrust action limiting, among other things, vertical integration of movie studios that forced the major studios to relinquish control of the theaters they owned. This Sony kind of the Paramount decrees are slightly complicated in that they mostly applied to the studios that existed at the time. Indeed, Sony was one of the last big studios to own a chain of theaters. They owned Lowe's a couple of decades ago. They divested their holdings there. But the repeal of the Paramount decrees did grease the skids for this, I think. The DOJ is very unlikely to take any action to block this move on antitrust grounds. That's at least in part because the Draft House is a relatively small chain. It's the seventh largest circuit in the United States, according to Variety, though it only really controls between, I think, 1 and 2% of the total screens of the country. It's not an enormous theater chain, is my point.
But it lives large in our imagination.
Right. We talk about it a lot because we really like it. But in terms of the total number of screens, it's not that big, which means that Sony can neither use their power as an exhibitor to extract concessions from the other studios, nor their power as a studio to extract concessions from other exhibitors, right? This isn't like Disney buying AMC or Amazon buying Regal, is what I'm saying. I'm also not saying there's no concerns about a vertical integration, particularly if this kicks off an arms race amongst the studios. But I don't think we're going to see a return to block booking anytime soon, right? I don't think the business is the same as it was in the 1940s. Things have changed enough that the worries are pretty limited. I'll put my cards on the table here. I think this is a pretty great decision by and for Sony. It's the studio that has remained most committed to theatrical exhibition. Sony doesn't even have a mainstream streaming offer, though they do have an anime streamer, Crunchyroll, and that's very successful for a niche product. Getting some hands-on experience with a modern theatrical moment will help them with their desires to, you know, prop up theatrical exhibition. I feel like Sony is well situated to try certain experiments, like setting up, say, gaming tournaments, right? Sony, obviously a huge player in the gaming space, the PlayStation series of games, Sony Studios. There's all sorts of interesting synergy that they have there. And Crunchyroll's popularity with younger viewers gives the studio a lot of room to experiment with having places for younger viewers to come hang out, right? If I'm in charge of Sony, I am trying to figure out who is going to be the creepy old man who goes to the high schools and says, "Hey, kids, you want some money to start an anime club? You want some money to, you can come hang out at our movie theater. You can get in my white van. I'll take you over there." It's a thing that helps build a generation of movie going habits, right? Or they could team up with, say, Barnes and Noble to put book stands in the stores. They could do manga, right? Very, very popular with the kids. Honestly, the thing I worry about most as a fan of the Draft House is the potential for Sony to disrupt the Draft House's ethos, right? The commitment to good audience behavior. Does the studio really want to be in the business of kicking customers out who behave poorly? Does a movie studio really understand how to run a restaurant chain, which is kind of what the Draft House is, really? It's more of a restaurant business, a bar business, than a pure movie purveyor. Is Sony going to do petty things like kill the Kubrick-themed carpeting, right? The Shining, the carpet from The Shining is all over the Draft Houses, you know, I've been to. But that's a Warner Brothers release. I don't know if Sony's going to want to keep that in the theaters. I don't know. All in all, I think this is probably a good thing. Peter, what do you make of the move?
I think this is a good thing. I think it's unlikely to attract antitrust scrutiny from the DOJ or the FTC, and not just because of the smallness here, but because it's not at all obvious that there's none of the things that someone like Lina Khan or like some of the other antitrust warriors in the Biden administration look for in an antitrust case appear to be present here, where there might be, they've taken an approach to antitrust that is mostly, that is not really about consumers, but is instead about competitors. And it's not, it doesn't look like this is the kind of this is the kind of merger that competitors are going to object to. And that's where you would see the Biden administration step in. I've mostly taken the other side in those cases. I think the Biden administration is overreached, but in this case, I don't think they're going to put their hands on this one. I think this is good for movies and movie theaters overall. It should be. Now, there's some, you know, caveats to this, but it should be good for movies and movie theaters, because as you say, Sonny, Sony is the studio that is most invested in theatrical by not having a bunch of money and a bunch of their business tied up in streaming. And so what they have done over the past few years, even as the other studios and other, you know, sort of big movie purveyors have pushed into streaming, Sony has said, no, we believe in the power of theatrical. And if you believe in the power of theatrical, you need movie theaters for that. And you especially need movie theaters that can do two things. Number one, a couple of things. Number one, that present the movies well, right? Because if the movies are presented badly, then it's not a particularly good showcase for your product. Number two, attract fans, diehards, right? Which the Alamo does, not just by showing movies well, but also with their programming, with their sort of overall vibe and aesthetic, right? Like Tim League, the founder of Alamo, is truly a movie fan himself. Really seems to understand what movie fans like and love. At the Alamo at Bryant Street in D.C., they do all of these revival screenings. I believe they do these elsewhere in the country as well, but they're surprisingly well attended. Not every one of them is sold out, but it is very common to see a sold out Sunday night show of a 30 or 40 year old movie at the Alamo there. And that shows you who that audience is. They also have programs like Film Club and some of these, you know, horror nights on Tuesday or Wednesday. I forget which it is, right? Like that sort of thing. And those programs are persisting, I assume, because they are doing pretty well. And when I have gone to them, they have tended to be, if not always totally packed, like well attended in a way that it's frankly any number of new movies are not. So that's something that is important. And then the other thing is you need a movie theater if you're going to invest in the theatrical product. You need a movie theater that isn't going to close. And since we talked about the Alamo closing, if Sony owns the whole thing, they can kind of decide whether or not it's going to close. And they can say, no, we actually need this to be here and perhaps even to ride through a rough patch financially if that happens over the next couple of years, because we believe that this is the future and sort of the long term of the business. And that is pretty important. So this gives Sony the power to not close movie theaters to ensure that there is a high quality, fan friendly version of the theatrical experience out there, even if it only represents 1 or 2% of screens.
Yeah, Alyssa, that is the thing that is most interesting here to me, because, you know, Tom Rothman a couple of weeks ago, a month or two back now, gave an interview to Deadline, and he had thoughts about the theatrical experience, because Tom Rothman's big believer in movie theaters. He constantly goes to CinemaCon, the big presentation by the National Association of Theater Owners. He's just a believer in that sort of thing. And he said, you know, look, there are things that theaters need to do better. One of them is cost, right? The costs need to come down. Tickets are too expensive. Yeah. This is why Tuesdays are so popular. It's when most of the tickets are sold. You know,
$7 Tuesdays at Alamo. Theaters, if you're going to bring a big group, that's the way to do it.
Exactly. Theaters make their money on concessions, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And this gives them a chance to experiment with that and prove it, frankly. I mean, I do think that this is an interesting example of not only a studio putting their money where their mouth is, but also giving themselves a chance to experiment with a thing they need to succeed.
Yeah, and I think that the potential upside and the potential downside of this are largely the same, which is that, you know, we on this podcast have talked a lot about the need for the theatrical experience to improve. And I think part of what all of us like about Alamo is that it does the things that we wish movie theaters would do well on a consistent basis, right? I mean, the prints of the movies are masked correctly on the screen. The sound is well calibrated. The theaters aren't like physically disgusting, right? You know, there's not, it's like there isn't just like this miasma of sticky Diet Coke and spilled popcorn on the floor.
It's so amazing that our standards are you show the movie in a way where it looks right and it sounds right, and you're not like sitting in a pile of Diet Coke and popcorn. Like, that's our standards, guys. 100%. That's it.
Yes. I mean, we're movie lovers. Like, what can we say about ourselves? But, so, you know, I think the theatrical experience obviously needs to improve. But the challenge with improving it is whether you end up improving it to the point of being niche, right? And I think that, you know, I when the Paramount decrees, when the Trump administration filed to end the Paramount decrees, I sort of wondered, especially during the pandemic year, why Disney, for example, didn't buy AMC when it was distressed and sort of before it became a meme stock. And AMC definitely would have been expensive. It would have come with a lot of leases and liabilities. But Disney is a company that is really good at, you know, managing entertainment and food and sort of a premium guest experience, tiering that guest experience. And also it makes movies. And so, you know, I would like to see a lot more theaters operate like the Draft House, or at least like the option of a Draft House, right? If you're going to make money on concessions, have them be good, right? Like, have them, you know, not just be in the sort of like, okay, you can get a soda that's like much bigger than you actually want and candy for like six times what you would pay at CVS. But like, have food that you actually want to eat, like at the Alamo, you know, a la the Alamo. And so, you know, I am optimistic about the idea that maybe a couple of other studios and theaters will end up teaming up in this way and sort of experimenting with just improving the, you know, the actual experience of movie going, both in, you know, small niche ways and maybe on a larger scale. But I do think the question of how you improve the experience while keeping costs reasonable is really challenging. And I would love movie theaters to survive as a mass experience. If they only survive as a niche experience, like, okay, I will survive. But I would really like them to be both better and accessible. And, you know, some of the, like, maybe some of the commercial real estate costs are going to go down and it's going to become less expensive to, you know, lease the mall space you need for a theater or the downtown space to have a movie theater. But part of what's going to make movie theaters better is, you know, is labor, right? You're going to need people who actually know how to do their jobs as projectionists. You're going to need to pay people who can do more than operate a popcorn machine or like nuke some frozen chicken tenders. And if you want to improve the food offerings. And so there are just going to be some costs involved. And I worry that saving the movies ends up making them smaller.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly a worry. But again, these are all I'm not to be dismissive here, but these are all like general, broad, structural issues with the state of theatrical exhibition, right? Like
100%. Yeah.
If I the thing I would be more worried about is if somebody like Disney was like, all right, we're going to buy AMC. We're going to spend $2 billion. We're going to buy AMC. Because that is a that's a real situation where you're looking at a studio that will be able to dictate exhibition terms to other chains now and say, well, we're getting 80% of we're taking 100% of the gross from AMC. You know, why would we give Regal access to our movies so they can keep 30% of it, you know, or something like that? That could be that creates different issues, different problems.
Sure.
Though to some extent, Disney has already done that. It's not the same as if they owned a studio chain, but Disney, at least pre-pandemic, was already negotiating an unusually high share percentage of the box office gross.
Sure, but they're negotiating that across the board with all of them. I mean, it's, you know, it's that's a broader function of the studio having a lot of market power and being able to, you know, dictate terms. It changes.
Sure, that
things.
Was a product of Marvel and Pixar.
Right. And that
and
changes that all changes dramatically if they can then say, well, look, we also own we own 30,000 screens in America. Like if the other 30,000 screens want access, they're going to have to give us, you know, the same deal. I don't know.
Not to support this, and not that I think that it would be I would be I would probably write about or at least talk on some other podcast about how I oppose this. But if Disney were to try to buy AMC, I think that would attract antitrust scrutiny.
Yes. Yeah, I think so too. I think that
and that is one reason why it's less likely to happen. Not impossible, but less likely, is that no one in the boardroom at Disney is unaware of that.
Right.
And in fact, over the past couple of years, as the Biden administration has ramped up antitrust, one of the things that you've seen is just a huge slowing of the process of big mergers, because companies don't want that. They know that fight is there and they don't want to have it. So
yeah,
they are avoiding those sorts of big mergers that are going to attract that kind of scrutiny. And I think that's probably likely to persist at least through the end of the year. We'll see after that.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that Sony Pictures Entertainment has purchased the Alamo Drafthouse? Peter?
It's good. It's a little controversial. It's a non-controversy, I guess. But it's a little controversy. It's like a thing that people are like, I want to talk about.
That's what you say for everything. Alyssa, is it a controversy or a non-controversy?
It's a non-controversy.
Yes, thank you. That's non-controversy. That's
you're
the correct answer.
You're so confident in these assessments. How do you get like that?
It's drugs. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on the summer movie season, doing summer movie preview, even though it's June. It's not technically summer yet. Well, maybe by the time you listen. No, it won't be. All right, it's we're doing the summer preview. It's going to be fun. And now we are on to the main event. Hitman, out now on Netflix everywhere. Anywhere where there's Netflix, you can watch it. It is racking up the views. It is the latest film from Richard Linklater, starring Glenn Powell, University of New Orleans professor of psychology, who in his spare time helps out undercover police squads with their stings by putting together the mics and bugs they use to nail people who are trying to hire hitmen to kill their loved ones or hated ones, I guess. After the usual undercover cop, Jasper, who's played by Austin Emilio, gets suspended for beating up some kids, Gary is forced to step into his shoes and nail the guy who wants to hire a contract killer. Gary, who is played by Glenn Powell, at first as a sort of nebbishy loser who lives at home with his cats, slides beautifully into the role of the pretend hitman. He takes it over with gusto. As he continues his undercover side hustle, he starts getting more and more into it, researching his potential clients, figuring out what they want, and sliding into it like he's a method actor. It's really interesting. He's got a variety of disguises. He does the Russian cyborg thing. He's got a MAGA-adjacent redneck guy. There's a hit person I can only describe as Tilda Swinton crossed with Wes Anderson. Bizarre, interesting little look. But it's the suavely confident Ron. I'm doing air quotes here. Ron is the persona that he presents to Maddie Masters, who's played by Adria Arjona. He is smitten by her beauty, and he doesn't want to be the reason she gets wrapped up in the justice system. So Gary, as Ron, talks Maddie out of ordering the hit, and then Gary, as Ron, starts dating Maddie. And then Gary, as Ron, finds himself in hot water when Maddie's husband is murdered in the same fashion he suggested he would murder Maddie's husband if he was in the Maddie's husband murdering business. Intercut with all of this intrigue, we see glimpses of Gary at his day job as a university professor, right? He's giving lectures about psychology. He's talking about id and ego and superego. They're doing a lot of explaining the themes of the film in these segments. I love all that sort of thing. I love it. Just spell it out for me. It's great. And it's here that the screenplay, which is written by Linklater and Powell, is both most pedantic and kind of interestingly mystifying. For instance, at one point, Gary in his lecture talks about how in pre-modern civilizations, unlike our modern civilization where we imprison people who commit crimes against society and we oppose the death penalty because that's bad. I say we as in the, not me, but we, you know, just in general society. But in pre-modern civilizations, however, it was often preferable to murder a leader who would lead the society down the wrong path. Instead of, say, exiling them or whatever, right? There's no certainty that they would stay away. You just kill them. You get rid of the problem. All of human civilization has stemmed from a few very key evolutionary prunings at important moments. Is one of the lines in this movie, and I'm gonna talk a little bit about the end of the film here. So if you're worried about spoilers, I'll just say I like the movie. I don't know about Peter and Alyssa. I like the movie a lot. You watch it, but maybe sign off just for a bit, skip ahead a little, because I am fascinated by the end of this film, which I'm going to talk about now. All right. So Hitman is based on a true story. It's based on a reported piece. Linklater and Powell wrote the screenplay. Again, true story. Gary Johnson, real guy. But there's a big change. There's a big change between real Gary and movie Gary. In the movie, Maddie has killed her husband, and then Maddie and Gary team up to kill Jasper. Just murders, two straight up murders. And then they live happily ever after. And I mean this quite literally. It's like a fairy tale ending. They get married, they have kids, they got a nice house out in the suburbs. The American dream. The American dream. And they got the American dream by doing just a little bit of slight murdering. Just a little murder. They're bad people. They only kill bad people. Now I have two separate, almost mutually exclusive reads on what Powell and Linklater have done here, right? On the one hand, this is a film that is potentially, arguing that it is good, actually, if decent, mild-mannered folks like Gary Johnson do the world a favor by talking themselves into eliminating social problems like Maddie's abusive husband or the abusive bad cop Jasper, who is brutalizing kids everywhere. It is offering a defense, maybe a sotto voce defense, but a defense of people who, when confronted by an intractable social problem, change how they think about themselves and take matters into their own hands and do the slight murdering. On the other hand, I think there's an entirely different read on this, which is that Linklater and Powell are making essentially what amounts to kind of an all cops are bastards argument, that Gary, by adopting the idea of being a cop, by thinking of himself as a cop, by putting himself into a cop's shoes and getting into all these different personas where he's trying to convince people to hire him as a hitman, becomes an amoral monster. He basically talks himself into a state of amorality. He justifies himself and his murders in a way that's no different from the way that Jasper justifies his treatment of suspects. And I've seen folks declare that this film is completely unaware of what it's doing, that it's completely unaware, that it's blithely amoral. And I think that's wrong. I think Linklater and Power know what they're doing, and I think they're being very intentionally amoral. I'm just not sure if they approve or disapprove of that. I guess what I'm saying here is that this movie is a little bit headier than I was expecting from what has been pitched as a pretty straightforward romantic comedy with some, you know, side murder trappings. But it's like, hey, this is a fun rom-com. Everyone should go see this fun. It's very amusing. Like, I think there's actually something kind of deeper going on here. Alyssa, am I reading too deeply here? Have I gone off the deep end? Is this just a fairly straightforward romantic comedy?
So yes. I have two questions for you. One, have you seen Bernie, Richard Linklater's 2011 movie?
Yes.
About, yeah. So in that movie, for anyone who hasn't watched it, Jack Black plays a man who becomes involved with a very unpleasant, much older woman and kills her. And then everyone in town basically defends him because he's awesome and she was just completely the worst.
Also based on a true story.
Yes. Also from Texas Monthly. Second, do we think Richard Linklater has, like, you know, secretly murdered someone and is just, like, making movies about how murder is good?
Wait, is this his Where the Crawdads Sing? You guys know that the author of the book that movie was based on was involved in, I shouldn't say it was involved, had some adjacency to some suspicious killings. It's very complicated. You should just read the reports in the New Yorker. I don't want to actually allege anything here, but like there's some people who are like, what's going on with that movie, with the book?
Which is in part about how murder is good.
No,
I the idea that this movie is unaware of what it's doing seems incredibly silly to me. It's a silly movie, but it's enjoyably silly, right? Its silliness is sort of worn lightly. I don't know that I necessarily buy the sort of all cops are bastards interpretation, but it is a movie about self-transformation, right? Because, an enormous thread in the movie is the sort of question of the self and whether it's a stable thing, whether it's something we create, and whether it's something we can actually sort of radically change, right? A key scene in the movie involves Gary talking to his ex-wife, who is a therapist, and is talking to him about research she's read about sort of the ways in which like the fake it till you make it hypothesis can have a real effect on people's personalities. And the end of the movie is Gary sort of deciding that he likes the he likes being Ron, right? And he likes the person that he is with Madison and has sort of, you know, self-actualized this happy life with her. I mean, at the cost of a couple of dead people, but, you know, he's someone who has good sex. Like he, you know, he's appears to be a good dad to a couple of kids, you know. Like all pie is good pie, but he bakes especially good apple pie for the Catholic school that his children attend. And so
that's
I don't know.
So
that
it, funny.
Yeah. So I don't know that like, the, yes, the fact that they this like super murdery couple is revealed to be incredibly involved in their kids' Catholic school. Very funny. But I don't know that that's so much an all cops are bastards hypothesis as it is a very funny riff on sort of like contemporary grind set culture, the idea that you can sort of like make yourself what, you know, kind of whatever you want to be. And in this case, it's like, you know, someone who's pretty comfortable like tying a plastic bag over his irritating former coworker's head and like exchanging mock vows with his girlfriend while the guy breathes his last on the floor of her apartment. It's, I mean, I definitely got to that final scene in the movie and was like, I don't even know how to describe the expression that I just made, but was like, oh boy, this is a little darker than what I had signed up for. Which in a way actually makes that final montage of like Gary, it was like Gary slash Ron and Madison's like perfect life together even more amusing, because I don't even know, again, how to sort of describe the juxtaposition, but you know, it's a very funny riff on someone who thinks he's self-improved by doing some of the worst things imaginable.
Again, I think that's all right, but I don't know. Maybe I need my hand held a little more by the director here. I need to be told what to think of this. Peter, what did you make of?
You need to be told what to think of this movie, which every 8 to 12 minutes includes a scene of Glenn Powell lecturing a class of college students to explain either what just happened or what is about to happen. Like it's like literally the protagonist is coming in to footnote the movie for the viewer, just in case you were not at all clear, you know, slightly unclear about what's going on. And I didn't mind those scenes at all. And usually I'm pretty against explicit exposition, but it's actually pretty delightful because each one of those scenes sort of marks a chapter, right? And it both closes off the bit before and then says, and here's what's going to come next. And here's the intellectual underpinning is a little too strong, but here's the kind of the thematic idea that we're going to be working with, that we're going to be playing with in this next sequence and how it relates to what you've seen before. Let's develop this. All right, now back to the movie. It's really pretty great. It chapterizes the thing without actually using chapter titles. I mostly agree with Alyssa that this is not a comment on cops. And it's also not actually murder is wonderful. Instead, this is a movie about acting and a kind of about screenplay theory, because it's there's a lot of acting going on in this. I don't just mean Glenn Powell, you know, playing the role. I mean the character playing these characters. And it's about how in the process of acting, you can choose who you're going to be, and then you can take a little bit of that. The movie follows screenplay, sort of a three-act screenplay structure very, very tightly. And screenplay structure is somewhat complicated, but it can best sort of break it down with three words: thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That's what a movie is supposed to be, right? So a character is they're living their life, they're totally normal, they're fine, but maybe they've got a little problem, and that throws them into a totally new life where they have to become something else, they have to learn different skills. Then they get to the very end, and in that third act, they have to combine their old self and their new, and the self they experience in the second act, they have to combine that and learn the lessons and change, right? It's about change as a person, and it's a movie called Hitman. So this is just a movie about how someone becomes a hitman. And when you're a hitman, you can't be a real hitman if you don't kill people, if you don't do some murdering, even if it's light murdering. So the movie makes justifications to make the murdering seem basically moral, because the people who die in the movie's vision of cinematic justice need to die. And that's like, I don't think there's a whole lot more going on there. I think this is about telling that story of how someone becomes the thing that the movie starts out telling us doesn't exist, which is a hitman, someone who will murder for hire. And in the end, he doesn't quite do murder for hire, although he does murder with the person who asked him to do some murder. But then also he becomes a nice family man who has somebody else at that table that wonderful, perfectly revealing little shot at the beginning of the movie where Glenn Powell is like sitting at this tiny little single person table at his little kitchen by himself. Right. And then the end is just, oh, no, that's not who he is anymore. He has become by learning to be the murderer. Yes. By learning to be the person who was daring in the way that he couldn't be, the person who had the person who was more attractive to other people and to himself. He likes himself better that way. And I don't think this is a movie that's like really deeply trying to grapple with the real world consequences and morality of murder. I think this is a movie about becoming a hitman. And if you're going to make a movie about becoming a hitman, you got to have some killing.
I the only thing I will say in rebuttal to that is that I think the second most important scene in the film, after the scene in which Glenn Powell's Gary is talking about the importance of assassinating political leaders to protect the civilizational herd, is the sequence in which he is accused, I think justifiably accused, of being guilty of serial entrapment. And that is, I think, where Richard Linklater, again, Austin libertarian, would be one way to describe Linklater's politics, is I think deeply skeptical.
Is that
Gary
different
and what
from an, from some other kind of libertarian?
I'll discuss offline my theories on the difference between Austin libertarians and the rest.
I actually don't think I know too much about his personal politics, but that scene to me read like a kind of winking, joking acknowledgement of the fact that some people are going to look at this movie and be like, this guy is a monster. He's just entrapping people. And it's like, yeah, you know, but he's Glenn Powell and he's so charming. He has that great hair.
I do also think this is slightly a movie about how sex can make you dumb. because I mean, as someone who is, you know, of the demographic who is liable to be receptive to Glenn Powell's charms, which I am, very much looking forward to seeing him in Twister. Like, Madison just comes across as really not as awful, not just in the, you know, like she tried to have someone murder her husband, but like kind of like self-involved and not very smart or thoughtful and kind of reckless. But like clearly they have really good sex, right? And like the movie is sort of about how like he does this incredibly dumb thing, i.e. continuing to like date her and see her, even though he knows he should not be doing that. But also then he just like ends up murdering one of his coworkers. Like the two of them end up murdering one of their coworkers together. And like there's not a lot of like the end of the movie kind of reads to me as another fantasy. That maybe is sustained by them acting out these sort of mutual roles. But, like, the movie does not necessarily present them as people who are, like, they get away with this. They get away with, you know, the death of Madison's husband. But they don't necessarily seem like people who are built for, like, the long haul of mundane life. And I think the movie is, if not, like, really emphasizing that, like, their personal weaknesses are both pretty evident. And the end of the movie felt to me at least a little bit like a fantasy as opposed to a complete, you know, portrait of reality.
I agree that it felt like a fantasy, but that's because that goes to my argument that Sonny is wrong to treat this as some sort of semi-Straussian argument about like cops being all cops being awful or murder actually being awesome. Because the movie just is a fantasy. It is frothy and light and designed to be that way. It is designed to be
superficially light. This is how Straussian readings work. You take the superficially light thing and you hide the message in it. All right, so let's talk about the superficially light stuff. How good are Powell and Arjona in this. I found them to be totally charming. I was won over by them. Glenn Powell's great. He's funny. He's delightful. She is very attractive. They are good together on screen. And this has a great supporting cast. Retta as the police lieutenant, like whatever her job is with the cops, she's great.
The liaison.
And the liaison, I don't know. I thought this movie was very funny. I saw it in a theater. This is the last movie I saw at the Alamo Drafthouse by me before it closed. And it was great. It killed with audiences.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Nyack. No, I totally agree. I mean, did either of you or both of you watch Andor? When Adira Arjona is in that as well and is like quite good in a much more sort of subdued, tense role. And, you know, I think this is sort of the summer of Glenn Powell, as far as, you know, celebrity coverage has kind of termed it. But the combination of her turn on Andor and this should be getting her a lot more attention, just as sort of expressions of her range. She's really fun.
I quite like the performances. I thought that the script, even though it was a little obvious at times, and yes, it raises some of these moral problems. You're kind of right about this, Sonny, but not as right as you think you are, as is often the case. But what this movie was to me was it was exactly what I always want from a Netflix film, right? So Netflix gives us kind of two tracks of movies in a lot of, right? They give us The Irishman and Roma, and I like those movies, to be clear. This is an expensive, ambitious art project by a super well-known auteur director, and they're great, but I don't know. I've gone back and turned on The Irishman a couple more times. I'm not sure I've ever actually sat and watched it all the way through a second time. Roma's a great, great movie. Again, it's just not one of these things. It's a great movie, Sonny. Don't make that face at me. It's a great movie, but it's also one of these that I'm just, you know, I don't go back and I rewatch it over and over again. But then, like, Extraction and Extraction 2, they're superior Netflix films. I don't know. They're a little... I'll watch a third one, for sure. But, like... I'm always looking for something that is light, but doesn't feel like a guilty pleasure at all. It just feels like a pleasure, and that's what this movie is. It's just a pleasure and not a guilty one.
Did you ever watch The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the Coen brothers and Western anthology?
Yes, and of course I loved it, but because I
that's
love
light.
Everything the
that's
Coen
light
brothers
and
do,
great.
It's. A little, I think it's not, it doesn't have that sense of mass appeal. And whether or not Hitman is actually a mass appeal film, it seems designed to be one. And that's what I like. That's what I want from Netflix, is something that should play to the masses, that doesn't insult my intelligence, but also isn't just awards bait. As much as I like the awards bait, and as much as I like Chris Hemsworth beating the crap out of guys and shooting rocket launchers for a couple hours, I'm fine with those things. But this is what I want Netflix to produce 40 of a year.
So this is what you're saying is Netflix has found mid-cult, and you like it.
Yes, yes, and I like it a lot.
Okay, Alyssa, how do you feel about Netflix's foray into mid-cult?
I enjoy it. This was fun. You should watch it.
I also give it thumbs up. Thumbs up. Thumbs up from all of us, I think, is how we're going to come down.
Oh, wait. You didn't ask me for my thumbs up or down.
Well, I mean, I that's where we are right now. All right. Let's officially do it. Peter, what do you think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Hitman?
Thumbs up. Super enjoyable.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Great to watch with an Americano and a heat wave.
Once again, I said I got it right. I was right about this movie, and I was right about both of your thumbs. Thumbs up from me as well. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing over by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.